One quick rejoinder to what I just read there. I'm very grateful for Michael Young for extending that out to our Unitarian Universalist family. And to keep things clear, the president-elect himself is a member of a, he's affiliated with the United Church of Christ denomination, but it was gratifying to know that he had come back to a Unitarian Universalist church to honor and memorialize his grandmother. My final accomplishment of 2008, just a few minutes shy of midnight on the 31st, was to read the final page of this book here that I've been reading in bits and pieces over the past several weeks. It's titled Positively Fourth Street, written by David Hajdu, interesting name, H-A-J-D-U, Hajdu. It's a heavily researched chronicle of the early musical careers of Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, along with those of Joan's sister Mimi Baez and her husband Richard Perina. Like many of these types of books, it reflects the outlook and the biases in some cases of its author, and probably gets a little more gossipy in some places than it needed to, but it was still a pretty good read. It begins as the 1950s are ending and as its principal characters are finding each other, mostly in the environs of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and New York City's Greenwich Village, with some side trips to Europe thrown in. It ends in mid-1966 with the tragic death of Mr. Perina in a motorcycle accident in Carmel, California, just as he had published his first novel. Well, in addition to soaking up information that was previously unknown to me, like the fact that Bob Dylan and the novelist Henry Miller once played a game of ping pong, that was kind of interesting. I used this book as kind of a marker about what was happening in my own life as the events I was reading about were taking place. Yeah, okay, this was when I was a sophomore in high school when these guys were doing this and that. The book's time span covers my high school and college years, which began with my having absolutely no clue as to who these people were, to having my worldview significantly shaped by some of what they were singing and writing about. Bob Dylan's song, With God on Our Side, which Ms. Baez strongly promoted at her sold-out concerts when Dylan himself was still relatively unknown, provided one of the first cracks in my near fundamentalist mindset at that time. It was one of a great number of factors during my college years that put me on the path that my life eventually came to take. Just listening to a little bit of Bob Dylan. The core story of the book, and where it does get a little gossipy, is about the Joan Baez and Bob Dylan romance of the early 1960s. As the author tells it, again from his point of view, it was Ms. Baez who was far more caught up in the romance of their relationship than Mr. Dylan, who in a rather cruel and abrupt way broke it off when he became attracted to the woman who became his first wife. Some years later, well after this book ends, these two reconnected as musical friends and cohorts. To the best of my knowledge, they remain so to this day as they live out the seventh decade of their respective lives. Well, 10 years after their breakup, Joan Baez offered her version of her days with Bob Dylan in a song that is widely regarded as the best one she ever wrote. It's titled Diamonds and Rust. 10 years ago, I bought you some cufflinks, you bought me some things. We both know what memories can bring. They bring diamonds and rust. Just on the other side of midnight, in the first few minutes of 2009, I put my book away and actually went and listened to a recording of Ms. Baez singing Diamonds and Rust. And as I did, I decided it provided the better setup for what I wanted to talk about this morning, even more so than that recurring theme piece from the movie Casablanca, As Time Goes By, which we heard earlier. Still, I'm really appreciative of Jed and Jeff and John for playing that song for us today, so I'm going to play off both of these songs as I go along this morning on this first Sunday of a new year, as we take up the topic, The Fundamental Things Apply. Besides, I think Diamonds and Rust would probably be a little more of a challenge for you guys than as time goes by. I didn't want to spring it on you at the last minute, so I figured let's go with what you're doing, and I'll work these two things in. I'll work these two things in together. Thanks very much. That was a great job you did earlier today. Not that you couldn't have done Diamonds and Rust, of course, but diamonds and rust are the fundamental things we encounter as our times go by. And what they each represent are equally necessary, equally essential pieces of a life journey. We need to value and appreciate and value both of them because the things that wear away, the rust, are just as worthy of our attention as those eternal verities, the diamonds that we also see. Let's start with the rust. I'm far from being the first person to note that the only really constant thing in our lives is change. Our lives will be very static, to say nothing of being downright boring, if that were not the case. To do a little variation on that, I'd say that one of the more permanent things that we have to deal with in the course of living, perhaps the most permanent thing we have to deal with in the course of living, is impermanence. Indeed, one of the core principles of Buddhist philosophy and practice is that all life is impermanent. It is, that is to say, continually wearing or rusting away. And this is a reality we can grudgingly, reluctantly, even fearfully accept, or it is one we can embrace in a way that can actually give our lives added depth. We all know, usually before our age hits double digits, that we're not going to be around forever. But there, more often than not, is a time in one's life, I think myself, you know, my 20s, maybe into my early 30s, where you feel you have all the time you need to accomplish all you want to do, which is a kind of a de facto immortality. Now, in your rational mind, you know at some point the rust is going to start to set in, even though you don't really see it or acknowledge it. But as the author of the book of Ecclesiastes wisely counsels us, there's a time to gain and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away. A much more contemporary author, a woman named Judith Viorst, picks up this same theme in one of her books that has become, again, one of my sort of scripture texts. It's called Necessary Losses. Miss Viorst is the author, she's better known really as the author of a number of children's books, the best one being Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day, which you probably all had either read or had read to you at some point. But this book she wrote, her Necessary Losses, is clearly one for grown-ups, or as she herself would probably put it, for those of us who need to learn how to be grown-ups. And part of that learning process, so Ms. Viorst maintains, is learning how to let go of certain things. The subtitle of Necessary Losses reads, "The loves, illusions, dependencies, and impossible expectations that all of us have to give up in order to grow." You see, this is another one of those books where you can get the point just by reading the title and the subtitle, but it's worth working your way through it anyway, particularly for the way in which the author maintains her sense of humor, her very wry sense of humor, even as she deals with a very weighty subject. I'm going to read just a few lines from a chapter she titles Shifting Images. "We start to feel a time of letting go of one thing and another, our waistlines, our vigor, our 2020 vision, our trust in justice. We give up hoping to read all the books we once vowed to read and go to all the places we once vowed to visit. We even give up hoping that we will succeed in being underweight or immortal. We feel shaken. We do not feel safe. Suddenly our friends, if not us, are having divorces, heart attacks, cancer. Some, even our age, have died. As we acquire new aches and pains, our health care is of necessity supplied by internists, cardiologists, dermatologists, podiatrists, urologists, gynecologists, and psychiatrists, from all of whom we want a second opinion. A second opinion that says, don't worry, you're going to live forever." I did say she has a wry sense of humor. Of course, as Ms. Viorst herself well knows, no such second opinion exists. But I don't think it's actual immortality we really want, so much as it is the time we feel we need to see all of our hopes and expectations realized, rather than having some of them go to rust. But realizing that we don't have that time is one of the necessary losses that the author is writing about. And it's a necessary loss because it makes us focus on what we really do want and on who we really want to be in whatever time we have to accomplish that. It is the reality of rust, in other words, that drives us to seek out and hopefully find our guidance. So give thanks for rust. It's one of those fundamental things that apply as time goes by. Well, what about the dynamics? How do we give voice to them? I found myself looking for a hook to hang this one on and went back to a pretty familiar place. I found myself making a run from Joan Baez to St. Paul, not talking about a city in Minnesota. For all of my pronounced disagreements with the man's theology, which forms the basis of the Calvinist doctrine of original sin, I still think Paul of Tarsus pretty well nails it in that oft-quoted passage from the 13th chapter of the book of 1 Corinthians in Christian scripture, where he says the three eternal verities, as it were, are faith, hope, and love. I'm going to ask you to indulge me in a little brief sidebar here, a little side trip. I said oft-quoted passage because that's found, those three words, those three verities, are found in the well-known love chapter that gets read at countless weddings. I'm sure you've heard it. Love is patient and kind. It bears all things, hopes all things, endures all things, etc. They're very beautiful words. And I got to say, they've come in handy for me any number of times when I'll be working with a couple on their upcoming wedding. And they'll say something like, you know, we really don't want an overly religious ceremony ourselves, but do you think you could read something from the Bible so our parents will feel okay about it all? And this is the passage I choose, and it works every single time. And the reason it works is because it is one of those biblical passages that transcends the religious context within which it was written, to the point of being a universally recognized truth. In this case, it's the truth that faith, hope, and love will always abide, always be those fundamental things that apply. So let me offer you then my own take on these three diamonds. For me, the notion of faith as being blind and unquestioning belief in unbelievable things, well, that turned to rust before I got out of college, and thankfully so. But that's not stopped me from being a person of faith throughout my life. In fact, I would say my true faith journey began once I let go of the rather infantile notion of faith as unquestioning acceptance, which is really more akin to spiritual enslavement than it is to faith anyway. Faith, as I have come to understand it and live it, is simply the ability to trust in life and in the ongoing process of life. And truth to tell, that's always not such a simple ability at all, given the ways in which life can test us at times. The faith which I now try to maintain is one that allows me to believe that I possess the resources, both within myself and in some mysterious way from beyond myself as well, that help me to respond to both the joys and the trials that come my way. I find the terms, actually, faith and trust to be largely interchangeable in this kind of interpretation. Because for all of the dangers and uncertainties and fears that are around us, we still need to be able to trust in ourselves and in the ultimate trustworthiness of a larger life within which we are contained and within which we have our individual lives. It is this kind of trust, this kind of faith, that enables us to pick ourselves up again when some of the more cruel and capricious directions life can take are visited upon us. In fact, without this kind of trust, this kind of faith, those dangers and uncertainties and fears and cruelties, real as they are, would overwhelm us and leave our lives devoid of meaning and devoid of hope. Hope, then, is the second diamond. The second fundamental thing. Hope is a powerful, resonant phenomenon. It was one of the core themes, you may remember, of Mr. Obama's successful presidential campaign. A broad-ranging desire that was really even more of an ache at this point in our history for some kind of hope in our country and in our world, even if it wasn't precisely defined. That was one of the things that helped drive that campaign on the course that it took to its eventual outcome. Hope, as I pointed out in a sermon in early December, is not the same thing as optimism. Not the same thing as believing that everything will always turn out okay because we know that it doesn't. I don't belittle optimism since it's an attitude I try to maintain for myself whenever I can, but blind optimism is no more helpful and no better than blind faith. Hope, however, is bigger than optimism. To live in hope is to believe that human beings like you and me, who live with compassion and conviction, can affect positive change in our lives and can affect positive change in our world, even if we don't live to see its full fruition. Hope is the willingness to plant a seed for justice, for peace, for a more reconciled humanity, even when you know you won't see the full bloom. Hope also means living with an attitude or a stance that the future is open, that the past, powerful as it may be, does not fully define the future. And hope is believing that life continues to be worth the journey, with all of its knowns and unknowns, and however bleak it may seem at any one time. The writer of the book of Proverbs correctly reminds us that where there is no vision, which is to say no hope, the people perish. And so for all the ways in which hope, as we know, can be manipulated or exploited on occasion, it still remains a part of humanity's lifeblood, which is why it is another of those fundamental things that apply. And then there's love. Another diamond. Another fundamental thing. I'm not speaking primarily here of romantic or sentimental love. Real and wonderful as all that is, life would be pretty lonely without such love, in fact. But the love I am aiming for here, trying to give voice to here, has to do with feeling a strong sense of identification with or connection to the larger web of life in which we're all contained. It has to do with caring deeply and passionately about that life. Now this, I know, is not a stance or an attitude that one constantly maintains on a conscious level. I know I don't. I'm pretty sure you don't go around continually telling yourselves how much we love life, what with all the other things that are usually on our minds. And also taking into account those times when life doesn't seem all that lovely. But we do well to cultivate an underlying and sustaining assumption about ourselves, that we are a part of something greater than ourselves. We're connected to something greater than ourselves. We love something greater than ourselves, however we may choose to name it or define it. Such a stance, I feel, is essential to meaningful living. Cultivating such a stance, that we're part of a larger life that calls for our love, also serves as a critical and crucial reminder that we do not live for ourselves alone, or by ourselves alone. The late Kurt Vonnegut once wisely noted that one human being is no human being. Truly, that's a fundamental thing. We need the love, the care, the companionship of others in order to be human ourselves, and we need to extend that to others in order that they may be human as well. You can live by yourself. You can gather friends around you. You can love one special one, as the Reverend Fred Small reminds us in his wonderful song, Everything Possible. And whatever choices you may make along those lines, though, you still cannot be a full and complete human being all by yourself. Fred, in the same song, which we've heard sung here from time to time, goes on to further remind us that the only measure of your words and your deeds will be the love you leave behind when you're gone. So, diamonds and rust. They're both fundamental to our lives as we move through the seasons of our lives, as the years come and go. Rust is the reminder, the necessary reminder that our lives are time-bound, which in turn compels us to discover and live out our diamonds. This is one of the many reasons as to why we are in community, why we have a community here. We're here because one human being is no human being. We're here because each of us need ways of finding meaning and purpose, and faith and hope and love in our time-bound lives. We're here because we need a place where we can leave some love behind before we're gone. And we come here in search of a deep peace that will abide with us through all the seasons yet to come. So whatever this upcoming year may bring us as individuals and as members or friends of this religious community, let us continue to build a home of faith and hope and love and peace for all who come our way. Mindful of this, let's sing together our closing hymn, number 164, "The peace not past our understanding."